Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We're covering tonight the World Economic Forum, and we're live from there with our recordings of quite a few very interesting panel discussions. This is taking place right now in Davos, Switzerland. And we're going to be playing some of those clips of some of those panel discussions for you this evening. And the first one, Klaus Schwab introduces Ahmet Davutoğlu, the president of Turkey. What's interesting about this particular speech, this is not a panel discussion in this case, is he refers to the New World Order, and it's centered around using the G20 in some very interesting ways, not only economic, but political and social stabilization ways. But listen very carefully, and then we're going to go to their second clip, which is the president of Ukraine. So we thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Here is particularly important. But you join us not only in capacity as Prime Minister of Turkey, but you join us also as the chair of the G20 in 2015. A year in which, as you have stated, the G20 will focus its efforts in ensuring inclusive and robust growth through collective action. Mr. Prime Minister, we are all keen to hear your vision, your objectives for the G20 presidency, your maybe, if time allows, also to talk about your leadership in the reform process of your country. And your statement will be followed by a discussion with my friend, Professor Victor Halberstadt from Leiden University. So again, a very cordial welcome to you, Mr. Prime Minister.
Mr. Chairman, my dear friend, Mr. Schwab, distinguished participants, it's a great pleasure for me to address such an esteemed, distinguished audience. World Economic Forum is always the right platform to discuss world economic issues. And this year, I am participating in this platform not only as Prime Minister of Turkey, but also as the presidency of G20. In fact, in the last 25 years after the end of the Cold War, we had several shocks. Geopolitical shift in 1991 after the collapse of Soviet Union, a security trauma or a new security paradigm after 9/11, a global crisis in 2008, global economic crisis, and Arab Spring or political crisis in Mediterranean and in Middle East and North Africa. All these crises, despite of the characters are different, they are integrated and they are affecting all of us in daily politics, in daily economy, and in daily life, everywhere. So none of these issues can be excluded from the other one, and no country or group of country can be isolated from all these processes. Now, maybe in the history of humanity, we need a new sense of common destiny, to shape our future in economic, political, cultural sense. A new world order based on inclusiveness is needed. In that sense, in the last 25 years, one of the most successful platform or organization as inclusive from the perspective of inclusiveness and effectiveness is G20. G20 did emerge as a crisis management mechanism regarding financial sector. But in a very healthy transformation and transition, now G20 is not only a crisis management mechanism for financial sector, but also a very efficient policy formation and policy consultation platform among the leading powers. 2008 economic crisis taught us something. A crisis starts as a financial crisis, being transformed into an economic, widespread economic crisis. Then through unemployment, we faced a social crisis. And in many countries, we faced also political crisis, instabilities, rise of marginal groups in political life. So a financial crisis end up with a much more bigger crisis. And therefore, G20, in all the summits, discusses not only financial issues, but how to fix these integrated processes of crisis. And it has been very successful in dealing with financial crisis, fixing the financial architecture after the crisis. But now there is a need in the sense of mission. G20 has a new mission to form an effective policy coordination platform. In the sense of the structural aspect, G20 is maybe one of the most inclusive participatory process between advanced and emerging countries, group of countries. Therefore, decisions, consultations made in G20 is much more comprising because representing 2/3 of the world population and also a significant part of the 85% of world economy, a huge impact in that sense. Interestingly, also from the methodological perspective, G20 is original in the sense that it is not a very formal organizational structure. Sometimes some people may say this is a disadvantage, but for us it is an advantage. Having a flexible, informal character, it is much more effective because there, like in Brisbane when we met as 20 leaders, we didn't read national statements, but it was very informal consultation and direct to the point coordination of the issues. That's the advantage of G20. When we look at the global world economy today, it remains slow, the economic recovery, and uneven. And we are facing big problems. High unemployment is continuing, and it is becoming a long-term structural problem, which may affect political stability and other social risks may emerge out of these.
Okay, this second clip, I hope you got something out of that. They're using the G20 to consolidate around 2/3 of the world's population, the new world order. But anyway, this next clip is the president, Petro Poroshenko. He just was elected president over there recently, and he brings out a piece of the plane that was shot down over there and accuses, it looks like it's got cannon holes in it or machine gun holes. He says this is a shrapnel and everything. He makes a big production out of it. But this is a forum over there to condition people into this worldview against the Russians. So listen very closely to that, and then we'll have our third and our third and fourth. The third clip will be Russians talking about their economy over there under the sanctions, and the last one will be Anat Amadi, and we'll get to that in just a second. Thank you for listening. Here we go. This is Petro Poroshenko.
Ukraine was divided. Half of Ukraine want to go to the customs union. Half of Ukraine want to go to the European Union. Today, Ukraine is completely pro-European. More than 78% of Ukrainians are strongly vote for the European integration. The 1 year ago, It was only 16% of Ukrainians who support the NATO integration. Today it's far above 50%. All the time before, the question of religion, the question of language divide my country. Today, Ukraine united, and we are ready to provide a referendum for any question, including question of language, question of the structure of my country, and the unity and the unitarian status of Ukraine would be widely supported. On contrary, with the federalism status, which would be support not more than 10%. So Ukraine become stronger. Ukraine become more democratic. Ukraine become much more pro-European and ready for the reform. But at the same time, Ukraine has now the most difficult time in their history. Ukraine are now under the aggression. Aggression not only connected to the annexation of the Crimea. Aggression is connected when 7% of our territory in Donetsk and Lugansk are now also occupied. And the development of their last days are very nervous. And the situation which we happened in December give us some strong hopes for optimism. From the 9th of December, when it was declared by the representative of the Ukrainian General Staff and Russian representative, Minister of Defense of Russian Federation, when we declare the so-called artillery silence. Immediately from the 9th of December, the number of the artillery shelling was reduced from the 70-90 to less than 10. And I was very happy with these figures because that give us absolutely strong feeling that this terrorist who is opened the fire against Ukrainian civilian and Ukrainian troops are at least under control of Russians. And at least we implement the Minsk agreement. Minsk Protocol and Minsk Memorandum, which were signed on the 5th of September and 19th of September, is very simple. This is completely based on my peace plan. Point number one, immediate ceasefire. Point number two, from the touchline on the 5th of September, we should immediately withdraw the heavy artillery and weapons. Point number three, immediately release all the hostages, which is illegally kept on the occupied territory and on Russian prison. They kept my officer, including the pilot Nadia Savchenko, which is doing nothing wrong but defend their own country. And they were captured, delivered to Russia, and illegally detained in Voronezh prison. And this national hero of Ukraine has a hunger strike for the 38th day today. And the only thing we demand in the Minsk Memorandum, immediately release all the hostages. Point number four, very important point. I promise you, we will have absolutely clear and stable situation in Ukraine if Russia fulfill point number four. Close the border and withdraw all the foreign troops from my territory. Because now, and the data of our intelligence confirmed by the independent sources, we have more than 9,000 troops of Russian Federation on my territory, including more than 500 tanks and heavy artillery and armed personnel carrier. If this is not an aggression, what is the aggression? But unfortunately, and the final point of Minsk Memorandum is that immediately when we have artillery silence, ceasefire, if we remove from the streets armed person, we declare just the very simple thing, election. Local election under Ukrainian legislation. In a democratic country, there is not existing any other mechanism for democracy. Just the person who would be responsible for these regions of the Donetsk and Lugansk should be elected by the people. And this election should be under Ukrainian legislation, should be under with the presence of the international monitoring mission, and should be recognized by the whole world. Very simple. Ukraine fulfill all the obligations from their side, and we count that Russia and the rebels supporting by Russians can do the same. Instead of that, we have first attack, which was started from the 10th of January this year. After 24 hours, I was in Paris. I was among the 50 leaders of the state on the street of the Paris in the march against the terror. And I remember the slogan on the Paris street, "Je suis Charlie," and "We are not afraid." We are not afraid of the terror because we are united. And I was proud to be at that time on the Paris street. 2 days after March in Paris, on the 13th of January, we have the tragedy of Polonnaruwa, when Russian missile operated by Russian support rebels hit the civilian bus. And all Ukrainians stand in the movement, "Je suis Polonnaruwa." We are together with the victims of the terroristic attack on the Polonnaruwa bus, where 13 civilians, including one 14 years girl, were immediately killed by Russian missile. And 15 additional civilians were innocent victims who were wounded. I have here part of the Polonnaruwa bus with the hit of the fragments of the Russian missiles which hit in my people. And for me, this is a symbol. Symbol of the terroristic attack against my country. The same way symbol like Charlie Hebdo, and the same way symbol like a terroristic attack which was done by Russian missile operating by Russian officer against MH17 flight of Malaysian airplane, which were killed 298 innocent victims from 17 countries, which demonstrate that the terror is not a problem of Ukraine and even not the problem of Europe. This is a global problem. And the fighting against terror is our joint, we can demand our joint efforts. And we can win the terror, and we will win the terror when we will be united. Because we are not afraid. We are united. And the whole world now is demonstrating the strong solidarity with Ukraine. And I want to thank all of you for that. And the other thing I want to ask from you, not only be united, the same way like you demonstrate on the United Nations General Assembly, the same way like you demonstrate on the United Nations Security Council, the same way like you demonstrate in the G20 meeting at Brisbane, and the same way like you demonstrate in the European Union Council, and solidarity we have from all over the world, starting from the United States and Canada and finishing with Japan and Australia. We need to be demonstrate a solidarity with Ukraine, and the very important thing, we need to believe in Ukraine because we are fighting for peace. I am a president of peace. I am strongly believe that there is not existing the military solution of this problem. And we need to have a very strongly coordinated action to bring the peace, not only on my country, but to bring the peace in the world. Because again, this is the line of the front when we're fighting, not only for our territorial integrity, sovereignty and independence. We're fighting for European security. We're fighting for European values. Somebody said that this is very expensive to fight for peace. I think this is two completely different concepts of the world. They measured the expenses by price and said that this is very expensive. We and all civilized world fighting for values. Money and values, completely different things. And I think that if you are fighting for values, we win this battle. Absolutely sure. Thank you.
Okay, well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to this session to discuss the outlook for Russia. I understand this session was heavily oversubscribed, which is no surprise because Russia finds itself at an absolutely fascinating juncture this morning. Economically, it is facing a crisis following the collapse in the oil price and the impact of sanctions. Geopolitically, it's at a very delicate moment given the confrontation with the West over Crimea and Ukraine. And politically, there are a lot of very important cross currents right now, given that although President Putin appears to be extremely popular at home, there are growing criticisms both internationally and within Russia. So we have a fantastic panel this morning to look at the outlook for Russia at this very, very delicate juncture. I'm not going to have lengthy introductions because I think most of them are probably known to you and there is a lot to discuss. But on my far left, your right, we have Wu Jinbo, who is an academic in China who can put the situation into a geopolitical context and in particular look at the crucial question of the degree to which China is or is not willing to help Russia at this very interesting moment. Next to him, we have Alexei Kudrin, who is a man very closely watched at the moment, who was previously finance minister in Russia, is currently an academic, but has been voicing some very interesting views about the current economic situation, and I'm sure that many of you will want to hear what he has to say. Next to him, we have Sir Michael Rake, who is single-handedly representing global business outside Russia. He is the president of the CBI, the chief British business group, and he'll be giving us a perspective on how Russia is or is not open for business at the moment. Next to him, we have one of the most important bankers in Russia, Andrei Kostin, who is chairman of VTB Bank, who can talk to us about the impact of the sanctions on the Russian financial sector and the help it is or is not going to receive from the central bank. And on my immediate left, your far right, we have Deputy Prime Minister Igor Shuvalov, who is going to be explaining to us exactly what the Russian government can or cannot do to get out of the current situation and whether it has any regrets about some of the events over the last year. But I'm going to start with Kudrin to ask you. You have expressed some very strong views about the severity of the economic crisis and the challenges. And so I'm curious, when you look at the economic situation today in Russia, is it worse than, say, in 1998 or 2008? And do you think it's going to be possible to exit the current problems without a full-blown crisis? And the speakers will be speaking both in Russian and in English. I think most of you do have headphones, so do look for those. And I will say that although this session is closed to the reporting media, it is on the record and it's also being webcast.
Спасибо.
Thank you. A couple of issues which are extremely crucially important for the Russian economy. Probably we have already exhausted the previous model of development when an average growth was about 7% annually, and this growth was based on the growth of demand, and this driver, we have lost it. It doesn't work anymore. Even 2 years ago, with high prices on oil, we didn't get this growth. And the most important problem, low productivity, which doesn't secure, and this productivity is not supported by the competitiveness that we need, by the corresponding relevant institutions. And thus we have to have a totally different structure of economy. We lost some time, and we didn't finish building some of the relevant institutions and structural reforms. And this is also, I'm talking about myself here, because I worked in the government at that time. And, of course, not I was not alone in taking all these decisions, but there was a certain movement. There were shifts in terms of political challenges that we faced at that time, in terms of being good for our constituencies, huge expenditures for social support, and we didn't pay sufficient attention to infrastructure. So when we say let's start searching for structural reforms, well, we have to say that there is a share of the government and state in the economy. I mean, strong regulation on the part of the institutions, but at the same time, the government, the state, shouldn't work in the market as it happens today in the oil and gas sector, in industries. One of the problems is that state corporations were not successful in creating an innovation economy. This is absolutely so. We are doing something, okay, but it's 20 times less than what we had to do in terms of the competitiveness of Russia. So this model of state corporations failed. Social security, social protection, traditionally Russia and Soviet Union, the country was very strong in terms of social protection. But now we spend a lot on this item, but it didn't bring us any results. So we have a gradual reduction in poverty, but it's not adequate in terms of the resources that we invest in this area. And now it is important to have a specific social support and protection. And the remaining of the resources we have to use to fight a crisis situation, to support those who suffer as a result of the crisis, but it should be done more efficiently and in an economic way than before. We don't know what the price for oil will be. Now they say that probably the drop in prices will lead to the drop in investment, and then the prices will go up again. I supported this idea before, but it was before what the price will be in 2 or 4 years, $40, $60, $80. We don't know. We just don't know. There are quite a few factors involved here. And thus, we just don't know which will be the driver that will identify the key elements of this. The anti-crisis program should not contain the specific elements of supporting citizens or individual enterprises. The most important problem for the government is trust. Without the structural reforms, it is without these structural reforms, we won't have trust, and thus we won't be able to get out of this crisis situation, come out of it. Second, the steps that we have to take, they should be directed against the crisis situation in the area of social support or redistribution of resources within the budget, the so-called budget maneuvering. And so It means that the gradual increase in investment into infrastructure will be a structural reform in itself, and et cetera. And another point, sanctions are quite felt in Russia, and even under the conditions of sanctions, we can achieve growth. I spoke about that. But we have to understand that we have to have a vector of our activities to take steps to settle, to regulate, and then the sanctions gradually are going to be reduced. At least we have to know that they will be not increased, they will not be tougher, stricter, so that we could fix a certain problem at certain level and move ahead. If the sanctions are going to be increased, the 50% of the measures that we are proposing, they will be just inefficient. And the final point, it is very dangerous today when the government is hugely committed in terms of social support and defense expenditures, measures against a crisis situation, very expensive, to turn back to the central bank, to get additional reforms, emission resources from the central bank, to start to regulate the central bank activities, it is a bad way. Probably it will, and most likely it will reduce the attractiveness of the Russian financial market. We heard about bad expectations in the market if the central bank is going to credit major corporations, saving them. The financial policy in Russia will become worse, and the investors just won't come.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Professor Kludrin, for that very coherent set of, one might say, criticisms of the current policies. I'm going to ask the Minister to react in a minute, but first, you sound as if you have quite a clear idea about what the Russian government should do next. Would you like to be in it again? You can speak in English.
You're from Financial Times, and usually journalists ask me this question, and I always answer no comments.
Okay, well, that's a pity. Well, that buys the minister more time to think about how he can react to the comments of perhaps, maybe in the future, of a future colleague. But Minister Shuvalov, you've heard a number of criticisms that Professor Kudrin thinks you should be having privatization. You should not be using the budget to support particular actors within the system. I would imagine the banks would be one of those. And you have also heard that he does not think you should be turning to the central bank to simply support the financial sector. Presumably, there is concern about whether the reserves are sufficient and whether that's going to impact the credibility. What is your response?
First of all, whatever Alexei Kudrin has just said, I totally support publicly we always say the same, but in private we always argue. But here I support him, and the dangers. There are certain apprehensions, but this is not reality. And today, when the economy of Russia is in a very difficult situation, a lot of talks we hear and gossips what we plan to do, or the president of the Russian Federation plans to do, etc. We start with the central bank. The bank, which acquired its status a year ago, has a unique status and unique opportunities and possibilities. And the Russian government, even if there is a will and desire to control the authorities of the bank, it is not possible. And it was done as an institutional achievement And because of the skillful leadership of the previous leadership of the Central Bank of Russia, Mr. Ignatiev, they carried the work and they built the bank as an independent institution. Well, many think independence is a total independence even from the reasonable approach. No. They always carried independent policies, and the Bank of Russia became a single regulator on the financial markets, including it took independent decisions. We had a certain period of time so that the government wouldn't encroach on the authorities of the central bank when the government couldn't interact with the bank, but it's in the past. We'll learn how to interact with the bank through the board of directors and other instruments. Interact and cooperate with the leadership of the bank, but I'll be open. Maybe you know how it works. The Bank of Russia is taking its decision independently and often takes this decision against the position of the Minister of Finance and the Minister of Economic Development. And there are no signals that we have to change the situation. Often we have to listen to the Minister of Finances because that's his responsibility as a whole. So, both the President and the administration of the President, they understand the responsibility that we have totally, all of us, so that to maintain these achievements with respect to the Central Bank of Russia. And nobody is going to ask questions about the status of the Bank of Russia. Not a single additional measures to influence the bank so that we could squeeze out of them the liquidity, so to save some state corporations. We are not going to do it. We don't have plans to do it, and we don't have the possibility to do it. But we have still here gossips, etc. And, well, for instance, recently I heard that we are going to introduce a certain control in terms of currency operations, currency control, in other words. But we cannot even explain this position. Why should we do it when a dramatic change in exchange rate happened? People are scared themselves with certain fairy tales themselves. When all that happened, why would we do it to reintroduce the institution when we had, well, we personally, including me and others, we wanted to kill the currency regulation. And it shouldn't be there, the currency control. And it is difficult to recreate it. It's very difficult. If we take the law, it does not. Nothing, because when we have we had commercial banks before 2007, whereas commercial agents, we had a very efficient currency control. Then we lost it. Okay, there are many other things. There are no crazy people in the Russian government. Even if you want to see them, they are not there, and we don't have crazy ideas. We don't discuss them. Indeed, we have a parliament. Many think that it is totally subordinate to the Kremlin, but I am dealing with the economic policy, and I can say that you cannot order anything to the parliament. We cannot ask a president or Prime Minister Medvedev, please help us in putting through a certain legislation. It is not possible because they have certain, there are certain and sometimes very tough position. Well, for instance, sometimes they are against the position of the government, and sometimes interfere with the policy of the government, I mean in terms of everyday politics and activities. Wolf, about the legislation about MasterCard and Visa card, it is legislation that is very difficult to implement, and the administration of the president and the government advise them not to do it, the law which will be difficult to implement, which will be counterproductive, but they didn't listen to us, and they adopted this legislation.
Sometimes leaders of the Communist Party or leaders of some political factions, they say that reintroduce currency control through emissions, we have to carry out investment programs. They talk a lot, but we have to look at the legislation that exists in Russia, and it's quite modern. In Russia, we have problems in terms of the implementation of the existing legislation, and so that every would understand that everyone should abide by the law. But at the same time, when we hear these absolutely extravagant, absolutely different positions expressed, well, about the crisis situation, sometimes you identify parameters of the crisis situation, but Andrei Leonidovich and others and other colleagues and friends in the in this room, we went through the most difficult crisis in 1991-93 when we didn't have food on the shelves on the shops, we didn't have money, the enterprises didn't work, we had a natural exchange of goods, a total collapse of the country. The country just collapsed, the Soviet Union collapsed, and a new country appeared, the Russian Federation, and we had to learn to live in these conditions. Then, 98, people don't remember that, they don't talk about this, but probably we remember, some of us, that it was quite a painful situation. Foreign investors suffered, the Russian companies and citizens of Russia, because we went through the collapse of the banking system. Many deposits of the people were just lost, and very high devaluation. And then the crisis 2008-2010. So when we ask the question, what do you think of this present situation? Well, I can say that looks like it's softer than before, but this is just... if we take the depth and the complexity of the situation, I think that we are going into a longer crisis situation, more protracted one. Of course, what would happen if the prices go up? Alexei Kudrin said that nobody knows what the price will be, but the difficulty of our economy is going to be more difficult because our constituencies want more expenditures if the prices go up for oil. So nothing is good in this current situation. It is a very difficult situation. It's going to be worse, and the anti-crisis plan should be aimed at the adaptation to the hard landing, as we said before. We have to learn how to live from citizens of Russia to corporates in these difficult situations, and we have to carry out reforms now, reforms that we've been talking about a long time. Apprehension is that this agenda can disappear quickly if we get back export income. So this agenda will be changed, and that's what I'm afraid of.
Thank you very much indeed for that very interesting presentation. I mean, just a quick question before I turn to a view from the banking sector. When you look at the current situation, and given that you've said you think it could get worse, do you think that the cost of what has happened in the Ukraine and Crimea is too high in terms of the economic cost? Do you regret that?
You know that many believe, and many want to say this, that whatever is happening now is because of the crisis in Ukraine. I would say more. If we didn't have the crisis in Ukraine, and we would have the price for oil of 47 and probably below that, and we wouldn't have this factor, sanctions, Ukraine, etc., the situation would be much worse, tougher, because after Crimea and Ukraine and sanctions, because people don't link sanctions to Putin, because people believe that this is attacker Russia. Why he has these huge ratings? Because people see that its attack against Russia. So we have to unite around our leader. We have the mentality, certain mentality. You have to know the Russian history. And in these conditions of this high consolidation and with all the conditions, tough conditions outside and inside, we have to implement this agenda. If we didn't have this consolidation and the prices would be high, it would be twice as difficult to implement this agenda. So if we just put aside politics and just concentrate on political objectives, this consolidation and tough conditions, it's a huge starting point for reforms. But to carry out reforms in bad conditions outside and inside and with low support from the population, it is hardly possible. Nobody would dare to carry it on. So it's not that I regret. I don't regret. I'm just saying that it gives us a good handicap.
Just before I turn to Mr. Kosten, you're basically arguing that there is no chance of a change in the strategy towards Ukraine because of the economic crisis. Have I understood you correctly?
Me?
No. Well, I'd be curious to hear your views as well. You can choose.
I think
you ask him.
Well, why don't I ask both of you? That's the interest of democracy. You can both get a chance to voice your opinions.
I mean, I don't understand why you ask to change. I think there's a process of mutually finding the right solution to the crisis. And the more you press on Russia, I don't think the situation in Ukraine will improve. What we expect that we would like you to, or the West, to listen to Russia and jointly to find the common solution. I think what we discuss now, the German, Germany, France, Ukraine, Russia, I think that's a format we should discuss. Asking Russia to change the policy is not the correct way. Russia is very eager to find a solution. I can tell you from my personal meeting with Mr. Putin and Mr. Shuvalov, I'm sure would support me in this. Mr. Putin is probably more than anybody else is keen to resolve the issue. Russia is not benefiting from the situation. Russia doesn't want to benefit from the situation. Russia Russia is very concerned about the both economic and political situation in Ukraine. We're not benefiting from sanctions which are imposed by the West on Russia. We are losing from this situation. So I'm quite sure that we are very much interested in resolving this issue. But just pressing on Russia, just imposing more sanctions, will not resolve this issue. Russia, you can't speak to any nation with sanctions. No nations, I think, will bend to sanctions. No Germany, no France, no Russia. And I think that's completely wrong approach. I think the business community, I have to openly say that I'm meeting a lot of people here, no businessmen. I met at least, no banker I met, saying that sanction is the correct way.
Right, well, thank you for that very clear view. I don't know whether the Deputy Prime Minister wishes to add anything about that.
Can
not,
I
we'll turn
later to something? Because otherwise, you know, I wouldn't be able to comment after everybody.
Okay. Well, perhaps I can then ask about the financial situation and the banking situation, because the Deputy Prime Minister has said that the Russian Central Bank is independent. And yet, at the moment, you do have the Russian banking system with a large amount of foreign debt. I think you have $4.3 billion of foreign debt coming due this year at your own bank. Are you assuming that the central bank will continue to help you? And just how bad is the situation in the banking sector? Because we've already seen Trust Bank, for example, have a serious problem. How much help do you think you need?
Situation probably not bad, but it's different. And I would say it's not the way which I would like my bank to develop, because starting from...
Okay, that were the Russian representatives. talking very pointedly and very directly to the point about needing to make a deal, but they're not going to bend over backwards to and just give up all their claims and so forth on the Crimean or anything else. Our last clip is Anat Admani. She is a really stand-up lady. We're going to follow this by the second hour that I had an interview with her last year that when she was at Davos. And she's saying that the capital requirements that the banking and financial sector, there's still a lot of debt out there, and the banks are going to have to solve it with bigger equity and so forth, and they just haven't done it yet. But listen to that. We want to thank you at the end of this clip. We might just go off the air, but thank you for listening. And the second hour will be exclusively a rebroadcast of a one-hour interview I had with Anat Admani a year ago. Thank you for listening. Good night.
Well, I'm going to probably, good afternoon, everybody. I'm probably going to take a bit of all the buts that were said here and add a little bit more. So to the question of this panel, whether the system is sufficiently resilient, I strongly object to the statement. I'm glad almost two-thirds of you come in this way. I hope to convince even more of you that that's the case, because it's not just that it's not sufficiently resilient. It's not resilient by any measure. In fact, it's incredibly fragile. And that is not to say that you might find measures under which it's somehow better than some other time. I actually don't think it's that much better as a whole than it was before. By some measures, it's potentially even worse. So too big to fail was mentioned, so let me start there. There are about 28 global SIFIs, systemically important financial institutions. Most of them are much larger now than they were in 2006, so just keep that in mind. They are very large by any standard, just about the largest and the most complex corporations you can find anywhere. So Mark Carney, head of governor of Bank of England, head of Financial Stability Board, recently declared the problem majorly solved somehow in Brisbane. I'm glad that the resolution planning was brought up, because I was going to comment on that as well. So the FSB document from October 2014 and is entitled Key Attributes to Effective Resolution Regimes for Financial Institutions. The date, by the way, is 6 years, more than 6 years after the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy, 16 years since LTCM, the hedge fund, and 40 years after Continental Illinois, all of which showed already the issue of contagion across border and the challenge of resolution. And so here's what it takes us to come to just key attributes. Now, there's the issue that it tries to tackle, which I don't want to go too much into. When do you start resolution? Who is going to decide that a SIFI is non-viable? That point is too late. Fragilities will start way before that, and this system is so interconnected that one of those SIFIs, even suspicious of failing, is going to either trigger or be accompanied by more failures. There is no way, there's no collateral damage from that process in the best of all cases, but to see how far we are from a scenario here, let me just give you a few stats on that document. The word should appears 406 times in this document. And sometimes the should is a list of 12 things that should happen. So it's a big wish list of should be things. In other words, that are mentioned very extensively, it's to do with information, authority, legal, law, power, coordination, cooperation, all of those things. I urge you to look at that document. And just remember, the Financial Stability Board has no power of enforcement at all. So all of these are just friendly suggestions to the members. So I asked the panelists here just how many of these shoulds are actually in place. How close are we to any number of these many, many, many shoulds that should happen to get here? Let me give you the IMF's answer from just recently. The summary sentence, as yet, orderly resolution of systemic cross-border banks is not a feasible option. And then there's more statements about the need for political willingness to act, incentives for corporations are weak, achieving progress is proving challenging. So it's been a long time, and I don't see any end in sight to this. So I would argue that progress and resolution is way, way far away from being sufficient. So basically, if you argue that this system is resilient, or certainly sufficiently resilient, you better hope that we're not getting to that point where we need that that resolution that's so, so elusive. So what's going to protect us from that point of failure? Supposedly these tough capital requirements, we're told. Well, I have a very dim view of those requirements. Andrea touched on a couple of points, and I'll just be stronger on that. The risk weights have been a source of more fragility and more interconnectedness because of a number of design flaws that manifested themselves. Measures of capital to risk-weighted assets have not been predictive of financial health or resiliency at all. And there have been studies on that. It's not just the manipulability. It's the fact that they create concentrations on assets that regulations give very low risk weights for and other things. So that system is bad. And even when you go to leverage ratios, which I favor more, except not at these ridiculous levels, they too are based on accounting numbers, cannot be trusted, do not give appropriate warnings of financial health. So I'm not under any illusion that these capital requirements are going to help us. Even worse, and that was also mentioned by Mr. Enria, they repeat again mistakes from the past which want to rely on non-equity substitutes, call them the name, the jargon of the day, COCOs, GLACs or TLACs or bail-in, all of those things, that are basically debt instruments that magically in some scenario, again, in resolution or some other time, will magically be there to absorb losses. Well, our experience has been grim, and that's the most frustrating thing about it. We should know better than to trust these things because all the regulatory capital in Basel II that was there to absorb losses actually did not absorb losses. So it just didn't work. It didn't work. Memorandum of understanding, nothing worked that was in place except equity and plain equity. So I see the look. Okay, I just want to mention a couple more things. Quickly, derivatives. So no capital makes sense given where we are on derivatives markets. That's an incredible source of risk and opacity that's also a source of a lot of fragility in the system. On derivatives, one of the things that is harmful is bankruptcy codes like the one we have in the U.S., which give preferential treatment to repos and derivatives, allowing the counterparties to step ahead of every other creditor, including depositors. This is a huge flaw, but it's not been revisited. In other words, there are a number of other areas. I would summarize reform efforts as unfocused, sometimes too much on some issues that are not relevant to the crisis, and then too little on the things that really matter. And then they fail to learn obvious lessons that we really should know better than to be here. So I'm particularly alarmed, and I'm glad that there was all the buts here. If policymakers congratulate themselves and believe that we've done enough, because it's very, very far from the truth, unfortunately. So millions of people are suffering from the failures of previous regulation, and I really urge those who can do it to do the obvious things, and I have very specific suggestions here that can be done right away, such as anybody who can't fail must not make any payouts to equity, and in fact must raise equity in markets, which is what they would have had to do if they had normal creditors. and they were subject to normal market discipline. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we've had